this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Renee Martin from the University of Kansas about the research she is doing on deep sea fishes and the outreach she is doing on Twitter using Sunday Fish Sketch. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Renee Martin. Renee earned both her bachelor's and master's degree in ecology and field biology from St. Cloud State University while studying the evolution and diversification of deep sea fishes. She then moved south, where she is currently a second-year PhD student in the Smith Lab at the University of Kansas, where her research currently focuses on answering evolutionary questions pertaining to the diversification of lantern fishes and other deep-sea fish lineages. Welcome to the podcast, Renee.
Thank you, Nick. It's really great to be here.
So St. Cloud, Minnesota and Lawrence, Kansas are a long ways from the ocean. I guess, what was it like studying deep-sea marine fishes being hundreds of miles away from their home?
Well, I have a little bit of an advantage when it comes to studying deep sea fish when I'm studying this particular group. So lantern fishes are very, very abundant. They're actually thought to be the second most abundant vertebrate on the planet. And so over the last few decades, many, many researchers and many different fisheries departments have trawled them up. And so a lot of these specimens throughout the decades get deposited in museums. And so a lot of my work is actually using museum specimens. And so these specimens you can request on loan, or you can go to other museums and visit them. And it's really, really useful to go to these different locations to still be able to study the fish species that you work on. But in addition to that, I have actually participated in a deep sea trawl. Granted, you get to go to the ocean to do that, but they're generally a little bit more expensive. It would be much more difficult if I was working on a fish group that wasn't as abundant. I definitely got lucky in that sense.
And so I'm just going to plead ignorance on this topic, as I know almost nothing about researching evolutionary questions. I guess, what all is involved in your dissertation work?
I'm going to take a step back really quick and just briefly mention some of the work that I did in my master's degree. Normally, with the field that I'm working in, which is looking at the evolution of fishes, you create, part of your dissertation is to create a phylogeny. So kind of like a tree that shows the relationships of the group that you're working on to see which species is most closely related to another species. And I already did that for my master's. And so normally what you would do is you create these relationships, and it can be in any vertebrate group, it can be in any invertebrate group, and even in plants. But you can use both characters, morphological characters, so the anatomy of the organism that you're studying. And so you look at different things of that organism and compare them across a group. So if something has similar characteristics, you might assume that it's more closely related to another organism. But then you can also use the DNA. So the previous phylogenetic tree that I created for lantern fishes, I actually used DNA to create this tree to look at these relationships. And so using that tree, you can actually try to answer different questions about different parts of their morphology and how different parts of their anatomy has changed throughout time. And so some of the work I'm currently doing is looking at how their bodies have evolved and seeing whether or not species that are more closely related to each other have similar body shapes or different body shapes. And you would assume, potentially, that if you have a species that's related to another species and their bodies are very, very different, that maybe they live in different environments or they're using their environment in different ways. And so I can use my knowledge of their relationships in order to answer questions about their evolution.
And like you mentioned, your current work is on lantern fishes, or the family Myctophidae. I guess, how many fish are in this family, and can you name them all?
Well, for The fish that I work on actually live in the open ocean. And for an open ocean group, they actually have a lot of species. So there's about 252 lanternfish species. And I probably cannot name all of them for you, but I could probably name close to half. it's a little difficult, but for being a fish group that lives in the middle of the open ocean, 250 species is quite a lot.
And I guess, what are some of the overarching characteristics of this family, or what are some of the things you're comparing between each of the different species?
So lanternfish are quite neat. As you know, their name, lantern, would suggest that they have something, some sort of bioluminescence, and this is true. So a lot of organisms that live in the deep sea, which is an area that is very dark, have this bioluminescence. So they have the ability to make light on their own. And in fish, they can do this one of two ways. So they can either live in a symbiotic relationship with bacteria that are in the ocean, and these bacteria can bioluminesce, or they can produce the bioluminescence themselves. So in lanternfishes, they can actually, they have nervous system, and this nervous system can excite or can actually allow them to produce this light via little photophores, so little light organs that they have all over their body. And so they use these light organs generally as a type of camouflage. So in the ocean, there's light that's coming down from the surface, and as it goes further and deeper into the ocean, a lot of the different color wavelengths are filtered out, and they can't reach too far. And so when you get to the deep sea, it's kind of this blue-green light. And so the photophores that these lanternfishes have actually, when they turn on, they match both the color and the intensity of the light that's coming from the surface of the ocean. And since they have them on their stomachs, when there's a predator below them that might be looking up to see whether or not there's any prey items, the photophores actually obscure the silhouette of their body, and they use it as a camouflage. So this trait actually has been studied already in the diversification of lanternfishes. And so I've actually been focusing on other aspects of their biology. Again, like the shape of their body and whether or not potentially they're using different sensory systems, like their olfactory organs, to potentially be eating different food sources. And what's interesting about this group is they actually do something called a vertical migration every day, where all around the ocean, they swim up to the surface of the ocean at night to feed. So they feed on a bunch of little zooplankton, and these zooplankton, a lot of the times they can also bioluminesce. And then during the day, they swim back down into the deeper parts of the ocean at night, because in the daylight, up in the surface levels, there's a lot of big pelagic predators that they're trying to hide from.
How big are some of these lantern fishes? Are they just little 3 or 4 inch things, or do they get fairly large?
They're actually quite small. So a lot of the time in ecology, you usually have different types of trophic, what we call trophic levels, or the food web. And since they're so abundant, the ocean probably wouldn't be able to sustain very, very large lanternfishes if they were this abundant. So they're actually quite small. You could even think of them as the French fries of the sea. And most of the time when people see images of deep sea fishes, they think they're quite big because you usually have very nice footage that zooms really close in. But on average, deep sea fish aren't really any longer than your forearm. And lanternfishes are actually, on average, less or probably smaller than the size of a human hand. So they're pretty tiny. And there's some species that only grow as long as maybe half of the size of your finger. So yeah, very small, but they're still pretty cool because they can bioluminesce.
I guess you mentioned it earlier, but you were able to go out and actually collect some of these fish out in the ocean. I guess, what was that like going out in the field and trawling up some of these deep sea fishes?
It was really fun. Usually when you go out on different trawling trips, what ends up happening is you take shifts, and there's a net in the water. So when you're collecting deep sea fish, you can either collect from the bottom of the ocean along the seafloor. But since the group that I'm working on is a pelagic group, so a group that lives in the open ocean, you put a net out and you trawl for them. And so you have the net out and there's always someone watching the tension on the net because you're putting it down hundreds of meters deep and the tension increases. And so there always has to be someone awake watching for that. And half the time, even if you're not on shift, you want to see what's coming up in the net. And so you're always excited to see, and everyone always knows the approximate time the net will be coming up. And they pull it up off the end of the ship. And when we went out on our trawl, we used something called an Isaac Kidd trawling net. And the mesh size gets smaller as it goes closer to the middle of the net. And then once you get to the very end, we had a PVC pipe on the end that was winched on. And so when the species and the specimens get funneled into the pipe, hopefully that pipe will reduce the amount of damage that they get as they get pulled up from the bottom or from the deeper parts of the ocean. And so the winch comes up, and once you actually pull that net out of the water and get all those specimens into trays and start looking through them, it's just amazing. I mean, it's indescribable how crazy and weird some of the fish are that you see, some of the invertebrates that you see. I mean, we pulled up all sorts of jellyfish and shrimp with giant spikes on their heads. But then you start seeing the deep sea fish that have bioluminescent organs and they're completely black or they're very shiny. And some of them, especially at night, if we pulled a net up at night, you could still see them bioluminescing. And so even though you're awake for 12 hours, 24 hours at a time, it's kind of an indescribable feeling.
I guess, how long were you out at sea during these sampling trips?
So this particular trip, we took a day to get out. We were probably trawling for about 4 days and then about a day, half a day to get back in. So less than a week for this trip. It's very expensive to run a deep sea trawling expedition. There's a lot of other both government companies and private companies that will go out for months at a time. But this smaller trip, which included just two different labs, was only about a week long.
You mentioned that you're just getting a bunch of different species of fish and different vertebrates and stuff, and that must have been pretty cool to see. Was that aspect of it what got you interested in more of the evolution of fishes and not so much their management?
As an undergrad, I actually had an internship with the fisheries department, and I was interested in fisheries management. This particular trip itself didn't sway me towards evolution because I was already in the field of evolution by this time, but it definitely helped solidify my decision to keep looking at the evolution of these fish groups. Fisheries work is extremely important, especially since even with the group that I'm working on, since they're really abundant and they're a major and important component of the open ocean food web. But as far as my choice to study the evolution of this group, it was more that I stumbled upon researching the evolution, and that once I fell in love with that particular aspect of it, I continued that work.
Well, if you're ever one to dip your toes back in the management world, I just happen to know a management biologist just up the road and at Lake Perry. So you're more than welcome to come out. So.
Now, I love the fisheries work that I did, and would definitely be willing to go back out in the field again.
Next question is not really pertaining to your work, but your advisor, Dr. Leo Smith, has been posting a lot of pictures on Twitter lately. Does he let you play around with the fancy camera he's always tweeting about?
Since I've been at the University of Kansas, I've been surprisingly busy. I've actually taken fluorescent pictures on my own back when I was in Minnesota, and I've been around when he's taken his fluorescent pictures, but I'm currently studying for some comprehensive oral exams and writing my dissertation proposal. So I haven't personally played around with his camera, but I have had the opportunity to play around with the fluorescent scope and to see just the amazing things that you can actually see with both with clear and staining specimens and then also highlighting them under this type of fluorescence. So I do get to be a part of it. I just haven't, unfortunately, had the time that I would like in order to play around with it more.
And so when you're not working on your research or studying for your comprehensive exams, you're often working on a different kind of illustration. I guess anyone on Twitter might have noticed your name attached to a series of much better drawings than I could do with the hashtag Sunday Fish Sketch. I guess what got you into drawing fishes?
I've always been interested in art, and even as a kid and in high school, I would frequently try to take classes pertaining to different types of art, whether or not it was sketching or painting or even making different things out of clay. And when I ended up not going to college for a while, I kind of fell away from art and hadn't practiced it in close to a decade. And so when I got back into research, and specifically researching fishes, I knew it would probably benefit myself in order to be able to illustrate different types of aspects of my work and to be able to use those both for communicating to others and for communicating within my own publications. And in order for me to actually try to get practice and to stick to a deadline, I decided to create a hashtag, and that hashtag was the Sunday Fish Sketch. So it was originally for me to keep myself on task in order to try to practice more on a weekly basis. I thought maybe someone out there would be waiting for me to make a drawing every week, and that spurred me into actually keeping doing that. And that's how it all started.
And so you said you had quite a few, or you took a couple of different art classes and you like to dabble in it. I guess, did your first few drawings look pretty crude, or as crude as I'd imagine mine would look?
They were definitely crude. By that point, by the time I started it again, I hadn't actively drawn in, again, probably like 5 to 10 years. So if you go very, way, way back to the beginning of the hashtag, you will find my old drawings, and they're pretty bad. Definitely bad.
All right, and you usually tweet out what the theme will be on Fridays. How do you decide what the theme will be each week?
So when I first started, there actually wasn't a theme. It was just anyone that wanted to participate could participate. But when people started realizing they wanted to draw fish, but they weren't sure what to draw every week, they suggested that we start some themes. So sometimes it has to do with any holidays that are around. So holidays relating to Thanksgiving might include a fish named after turkey, or might include, oh, what would you eat if you could eat a fish for Thanksgiving? Other times, if we have some new research that's come out, I will include a link to that and say, hey, we have some new fish species that were discovered. Let's draw that as a theme. Other times, it's very random. Maybe fish with animal names or fish named after different colors. And then sometimes, especially if I'm busy, I ask all of our Sunday Fish Sketch people what they would like the theme to be. And so we'll choose from there. So it's very random. And I get my inspirational sources for a theme from a bunch of different places.
Has there ever been a suggestion or an idea for a theme that you didn't think you could draw?
Ooh, that's tough. A lot of the suggestions, when they come up, I definitely have, I'm nervous to draw them sometimes because I'm practicing myself. But I always figure everyone that's doing this is doing this to better themselves and to better their skills. And so I try anyway. Sometimes it doesn't come out as good as I would like it to, but I'm always happier at the end that I actually tried. Whether or not I'm happy with the actual art piece itself is a different story.
All right, and this episode will be released on March 3rd. What will the theme be for that day?
Well, today's the 1st, and if it's released on the 3rd, I believe the theme that I put out today is related to a recent Twitter video that I saw, which is of this beautiful poacher. And so a poacher is a fish in the family Agonidae, and you can find them in many different areas in the ocean. They generally live on the ocean floor, and they have kind of like this hard armored body. But in some different species, they have these really beautiful large fins. In others, they do not. It just depends on the species that you're looking at. And so because of this video, the theme that we decided on for this week was fishes or species in Agonidae, which the common name is the poachers.
Well, one of these weeks, I might just have to try out my hand at drawing a fish, but I don't know about drawing a poacher after seeing that video. It looked like a pretty tough fish to draw at first.
You can definitely start on a week that we maybe have something that looks more like a fish and less like an armored something.
Well, Renee, thank you for filling us all in on your research and the Sunday fish sketch. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
You expect, or would expect, since I work on deep sea ocean fish, that might be one of my favorite fishes. But I actually, my favorite fish is the bluegill sunfish. And it's probably for two different reasons. One is that as a kid, I used to catch them all of the time, and they were one of the easiest things to catch. And so I always got a ton of sunfish. And two is that actually, depending on what lake you're in or your particular location, they can be extremely beautiful. They have a bunch of different color morphs. And I just, whenever I think about the career path that I chose, my favorite fish is definitely just a bluegill sunfish.
All right. And what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
So you already brought this up, but actually my favorite memory is the deep sea trawling trip that I went on. So both the actual invitation to go on the trip itself and the event as it was going on. It's so much more different seeing deep sea fishes alive and fresh compared to looking at museum preserved specimens. And just knowing that the organisms that you're bringing up are from the deep, deep parts of the ocean, it's a trip that I'll never forget.
What is your dream job or dream location to work in?
So my dream job would be to either work at a museum as an ichthyology curator. So a curator is someone that will go and will try to get different types of fish for the museum and just make sure that the collection itself is taken care of. If not that, I would definitely like teaching at a university, doing my own independent research while also teaching students. I do really enjoy educating people about the work that I do because I'm excited about the work that I do. And I think it would be really, really enjoyable to have students that are passionate about their own work and to see them grow as well.
All right. So you're in the middle of your PhD, so you might not want another project, but if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
It would probably be something related to looking at the behavior of deep sea fishes. And so what would be required of that is to be able to go down into a deep sea submersible and be a part of a team of researchers that might partake in using ROVs or the remote operated vehicles, and to be able to go into the deep sea and just see the actual bioluminescence happening, seeing all the organisms in the middle of the water column. That would be a dream project for me.
And believe it or not, you are not the first guest to bring up their dream project being seeing how these deep sea fishes interact in their bioluminescence and all that.
Really?
Dr. Chris Kennealy from Boston College also, he in the past he had done a lot of work with deep sea fishes, and he had wanted to develop instrumentation to see how different light patterns and frequencies and all that affected these deep sea fishes.
We can study their morphology, and that's pretty easy because we can get a lot of specimens from trawls. But once we actually see what lantern fishes are doing with their photophores other than camouflage, whether or not they're flashing patterns at each other, and whether or not those patterns are based on, you know, species by species, or whether or not they're using them only for predation, we can't actually know whether, you know, what they're doing with them until we see them happening. We can only postulate and make educated hypotheses about it. So I can definitely see why Chris would. He studied deep sea dragonfishes, which like to eat lanternfishes too. And I completely agree with him.
All right. And the final question, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
So I'm going to take the route of someone that studies pelagic fish in the ocean and say that plastic is a major issue. And I know that a lot of news sources and news outlets have been mentioning the plastic garbage patches that you see in the ocean. And I guess what I would want to have programmed into everyone's head is that the plastic in the garbage, after you use it, it just doesn't disappear. And that trash floating in the ocean is actually a very big issue. I don't think people on an individual basis think that they can make a personal impact. But if they knew that by just making choices, consistent choices to use both eco-friendly or reusable resources, that as a whole, it actually does make an impact. And so I think that is what I would want people to get programmed in their head. It doesn't have to be immediate, but just something to think about and something to realize.
Well, Renee, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and the work you're doing for your dissertation and with Sunday Fish Sketch. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
So they can either follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @lampichthys. Again, we talked about the Sunday Fish Sketch, so you'll always be able to find me at that hashtag as well. If you also look me up at the University of Kansas, you can find different ways to reach me there.
And if you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter @FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Listen in next week when I chat with a group of three graduate students from Iowa State about the research they are doing on their various projects. You can download that episode and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 28th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, plastic is an issue, and we all need to use alternatives.